The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Tonight, I'm Siobhan Reardon, and for those of you I don't know, I'm president and director here at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and it is a privilege to have you all here tonight. A bit of housekeeping. So if you have something that rings, bings, vibrates, or whatever, shut it off, please, until after. And then, of course, you know, we have our book signing after the program tonight. We are the Free Library of Philadelphia. As I was saying to some of the folks upstairs, we had a reception for some of our donors tonight, really talking about the importance of the Free Library of Philadelphia, particularly during an economic crisis, and just how the worth and value of an organization like this has been to the city of Philadelphia. To the point where we now know that we helped nearly 1,000 people find a job last year. We helped over 8,600 entrepreneurs with the tools they needed to start or improve their small business. Thank you. And on an annual basis, we answer more than 3 million reference questions. Reference is not dead yet. I don't care what other fellow... for all of you who contribute to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and that's a part of tonight's activities as we contribute to the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation, we couldn't thank you from the bottom of our hearts on behalf of the staff and the boards here. Your support is needed and important as we help provide the kind of wonderful programming like tonight's program. We have, when we talk about wonderful programming, we're about to kick off our summer reading program, or what we call our summer reading game, where we work with over 60,000 children during the summer. We have our One Book, One Philadelphia program, also funded by the foundation, will be celebrating its 10th anniversary in January. And, of course, you cannot really experience the wonderful collections until you go up to our rare book collection or look at our automobile collection and really experience some real world-class special collections here at the Free Library, all for you. Our organization is an essential part of this city, and we just are very grateful that you're all here supporting the work that we do. So give yourselves a round of applause, really. Thank you. We have a simply fabulous author and writer here tonight, Eric Larson. He is a master of narrative nonfiction, author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, Thunderstruck, Isaac Storm, and Devil in the White City, which was beyond fabulous. Devil in the White City stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years. A graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and former writer for the Wall Street Journal. We love New York. We love Penn. Don't we love Penn here? We love Drexel. We have Temple. Right. Graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and former. And those of us who came from Fordham University, you know. he was a former writer for the Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, and the Bucks County Courier Times. Yes, we have to talk about Bucks County, don't we? It is part of Greater Philadelphia. His new book is now entitled In the Garden of Beasts, and it's set in Hitler's Berlin. Praise for In the Garden of Beasts is gripping, a nightmare narrative of a terrible time. It raises again the question never fully answered about the Nazi era, what evil humans are capable of and what means are necessary to cage the beast. It is our honor and our privilege, and please welcome Eric Larson to the Free Library. Back to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
That's water, by the way. It's not vodka. So it is great to be here back in Philadelphia. I am a homeboy of sorts. I went to Penn. I also lived for a while at 22nd and Spring Garden in a fabulous apartment. Loved it. I worked for the Wall Street Journal first, actually in the Wall Street Journal Philadelphia Bureau, as a matter of fact. I know that's a surprise maybe to some of you that we existed here, but that bureau has since closed. But it was I loved Philadelphia. I loved I have the distinction, actually, of writing the first and I believe only front page story for the Wall Street Journal about a dead man. The particular dead man was a fellow named Frank Sindone. Does that name ring a bell with anybody? He was a loan shark. And I remember when I came up with the idea, see, the reason I was able to get the idea past the editors was because when I started the story, he was alive. So I started doing the reporting, you know, talked to everybody, had lunch with a really interesting cop who was in charge of the organized crime outfit at the Philadelphia Police Department. And over lunch, he told me, he said, you know, you might need to pick another subject. And I said, well, why? He says, well, there's a contract out on Frank Sindone. And to me, this is like TV stuff. I'm like, oh, come on. You know, you're kidding me, right? He said, no, I'm serious. There's a contract out to kill him. So I went back, kept that from my bureau chief, continued doing my research, you know, found all this very interesting stuff about Frank Sindone thanks to the Pennsylvania Crime Commission. I don't know if it still exists, but it was a wonderful operation because, you know, it provided material that we could actually quote without having to worry about getting sued or killed. And so one day I'm chugging along with this story. I'm just about ready to run this thing, you know, and it's going through the editing process, and I get a phone call. It's this guy from the organized crime unit at the police department. He says, well, Eric, I got some good news and some bad news for you. And I say, what's the good news? He says, well, he says, it's the same thing, really. He says, well, we found Frank this morning in two trash bags. But they ran the story anyway, so I was delighted to have made Wall Street Journal history. But anyway, let me just say, first of all, that, and I'm not, believe me, I am not sucking up here. Well, I've been known to suck up in the past. I am not sucking up here. I am actually a tremendous fan of libraries. I like to think of myself, in fact, as the Indiana Jones of libraries, rappelling down the 900 levels of the books, you know, and the Dewey Decimal System. Melville Dewey, by the way, having been, this may come as a shock to people, a rabid anti-Semite. Now you know. I love libraries so much, in fact, that if you were to give me a choice between a night with Kate Blanchett and a night locked in the Library of Congress alone, I'd take the night with Kate Blanchett in a heartbeat. In a heartbeat. But I do love libraries. And in fact, when I was doing the research for Devil in the White City, I actually spent a little time in this very library looking into some very old books about what Philadelphia was like back in the 1890s and also looking over some old fire insurance maps, which show very detailed depictions of every block in the city. It was a very nice visit back here. I thought I'd talk tonight a little bit about this new book of mine, In the Garden of Beasts, as a way of sort of talking about how I come up with ideas. The book, by the way, in my publishing company, I guess people are kind of too lazy to say the complete title of the book, so they've reduced it to its acronym, which is ITGOB. ITGOB. And which I'm not sure how I feel about it. It sounds to me a little like something a cat would cough up, but I've also learned, since I fundamentally have the mentality of a 9-year-old, I've also learned that if you say ITGOB while growling, you sound just like the possessed girl in The Exorcist. And I'm not going to ask you to do it. Don't worry. Don't worry. You can do that at home. I'm going to talk about how the idea came about, really, because, you know, at first glance, it may not seem like the kind of thing I typically do. I mean, you know, my last three books were set in or around the year 1900 and tended to involve fairly obscure subjects. And in fact, you know, one of the things that I pride myself on is finding ideas that once upon a time were a very big deal, but for one reason or another have been largely forgotten.
So you may ask, those of you who are wise guys, you may ask, if that's the case, why did I choose to do a book set in the early years of Hitler's rule? And my answer to that is that, really, this is exactly the kind of book that is right up my alley, because it's about a period that people think they know an awful lot about, but don't. I certainly thought I knew a lot about this period, but I'm here to tell you that it proved to be a fascinating journey for me. So here's how this idea came about. And I promise you I'll tell you the subject of the book shortly. It's called Suspense. Here's how the idea came to me. The idea hunt for me is a very rough time, because whenever I finish a book, I'm not like other writers. David Halberstam, God, may he rest in peace, David Halberstam had the next 10 book ideas set out, and he, I'm sure, would have done them. For me, though, every time I finish a book, I essentially start with a blank slate. All the ideas that I considered before I chose one have withered and died. I start with a fresh slate. And that's very hard for me because I want to feel productive, and it's hard to feel productive when you're sitting around all day sucking your thumb or reading or something. And my family hates it because I get very pouty, pissy, annoying, which is not that that's terribly unusual. But so the idea hunt for me is a very tough time. So I was in this, as my publicist and friend refers to it. She has dubbed it the dark country of no ideas. I was in this dark country of no ideas, and this is about 5 or 6 years ago, and I decided to follow my own advice, the advice I give to writing students, which is when you want to try to get your mind, you want to jumpstart things, go out and read voraciously and promiscuously. So following my own advice, I went to an August day 5 or 6 years ago in Seattle, a hot, sunny August day. I went to a bookstore and just decided I was going to browse the history section of the bookstore just to get a feel for what books drew me to them. You know, what covers drew me to them, what subjects maybe just absolutely bored, and so forth. I saw a book, Face Out, that had always been on my list to read. But it had always been sort of an intimidating book, 1,200 pages, tiny type, no photographs. A lot of you are thinking, oh, it's the Bible. That's right. It's not the Bible. It was William Shire's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. So I bought it, brought it home, started reading. I loved it. If you can truly say that you love a book about the Third Reich. Read like a thriller. I was totally engaged. I must be a fairly slow on the uptake, but it was about a third of the way through the book that I realized, wait a minute, William Scheer had actually been there in Berlin from 1934 on. He had actually met these people that we all know today to be the monsters of forever. Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, Himmler, Heydrich, all these awful people. Suddenly my imagination caught fire. What would that have been like to have met these people at that time, when you didn't know the ending? We all know how things turned out. But what would it have been like to have been there at the time? If you had been sitting in one of Berlin's really wonderful cafes on a lovely spring day in 1933 and happened to see Hitler be driven by around the amazing traffic circle at Potsdamer Platz, what would you have felt? Would you have felt a chill? Would you have leapt to your feet, raising your hand to do the thing? Would it just have been background noise and you wouldn't have paid much attention at all? So I started thinking, maybe it'd be interesting to try to do a book where we look at this period, and again, I'm talking about the very early period, 33-34. I have to be especially careful to note this is not a World War II book, and it is not a Holocaust book. This is before. This is 33-34, period when Hitler was chancellor, had yet to attain absolute power, but during the course of the book, he does so. So I thought it'd be so interesting, to me at least, to try to capture a sense of this time through the point of view of those who were living at that point. What I needed were a couple of real-life characters, outsiders, ideally Americans, because I write for an American audience. So I began to read. Went to my library, Sousa Little Library. Took out all the grand histories, read those. Took out as many personal memoirs and diaries as I could. Fascinating, fascinating. All the ones by Germans, you know. It's always kind of amazing how many Germans after the war turned out to have been ambulance drivers during the war. It's just a small little interesting side note. What I needed were a couple of interesting characters. At some point, I can't tell you exactly when, I came across the diary of a man, a Chicago man, named William E. Dodd. And soon afterwards, I came across a diary by his daughter, Martha. I mean, a memoir by his daughter, Martha. So let me set the scene. Try to imagine this. Try to put yourself in this moment. Suppose for the moment that you are William E. Dodd. You are 63 years old. You are a mild-mannered professor of history at the University of Chicago. You are really tired of the demands of academia. And those of you who are professors and so forth, I'm sure you know exactly what point he was at in his career. He was really fed up with the engulfing demands of graduate students. His department was underfunded, in part because of the Depression, in part because academic departments are always underfunded. And above all he wanted to do was finish his book. It was actually a multi-volume series, which he entitled, ironically, it was The Rise and Fall of the Old South. This is what he wanted to finish. This is the thing that was going to be his ultimate legacy, his claim to fame. Suddenly, one very hot day in June of 1933, you, William E. Dodd, are sitting at your desk, and the phone rings at noon. You pick up the phone. The guy at the other end is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who has been president since March. Now, by the way, Inauguration Day in 1933 was in March. It subsequently was changed to January. He asks you to be the next ambassador to Germany, America's first ambassador to Nazi Germany. The job has been vacant for about 6 months at this point. Here's the thing. He gives you 2 hours to decide. What you don't know, what he neglects to tell you, is that one reason he's asking you to do the job, partly because, apart from the fact that you are known to speak German pretty well, but one reason he's calling you is because nobody else wanted the job. Many had already turned it down. Surprise, surprise. 3 weeks later, you are on a ship to Germany, and you've got your family with you. Your wife, a grown son, and your 24-year-old daughter, Martha. Now, Martha was quite the young lady. She's the one who hooked me. She's smart, sexy, and she has this way about her that inflames the passions of men, not just young men, but also not so young men. At 24, she has already had an affair with the poet Carl Sandburg. And indeed, one of the charming moments of the research process for me was when I was at the Library of Congress going through her papers, and I came across 2 locks of Carl Sandburg's hair in a little clear plastic archival envelope tied with black coat strings, so they looked like little broom heads. And I'm here to tell you that, in fact, his hair was white and was actually quite sort of abnormally coarse. Very interesting. By 24, she has broken 2 engagements and is now in the midst of a divorce to escape a dead marriage to a New York banker. Now, personally, I don't know if there's any other kind of marriage to a New York banker, but I don't want to inject my own views on this, but she comes along to Berlin for the adventure and immediately falls in love with what she calls the Nazi Revolution. She falls in love with the Nazi Revolution.
That's right. I only like that. She finds it intoxicating at first. But here's the thing. She was not alone. This was a fairly common view at this time in 1933. Quite a few people thought Hitler was good for Germany. Their argument, you know, you could quarrel with his approach, but he was restoring Germany's pride. Cut him some slack. Indeed, the night before the Dodds left New York, they gathered in New York to catch their ship. The night before, they had dinner at the fabulous apartment of a very rich philanthropist by the name of Charles R. Crane, who was also a big contributor to Dodd's department at the University of Chicago. And by the way, you gentlemen in the audience, you know the Crane Company's logo. You have seen it on innumerable urinals throughout the country. Charles Crane pulls... I can't speak for the ladies. Charles Crane pulls Dodd aside as he's leaving the apartment, and he says to him, "Let Hitler have his way." He also advises Dodd sternly not to have any social interaction with Jews in Germany. Now let's look at the world through Martha's eyes. She finds herself newly freed or almost free in a vibrant, charismatic city. This is Berlin in 1933. I always at least, think of that world back then as being sort of a drab place of black and white, shaded in gray, mainly because what I'm accustomed to seeing are black and white photographs, newsreel footage, and so forth. You know, to me, it's like Berlin from 1933 through 1945 is perpetually cloudy. You know, there's no sunny days at all. But that's obviously not the way it was. You know, she saw something very different. She arrives. It's a city. There's a vibrant, packed, lovely city. It's color everywhere. The trams are brightly colored and move like toys along all the main streets of the city. Every balcony seems to have a box full of red geraniums. At Christmas, there are Christmas lights everywhere, Christmas trees everywhere, Christmas trees in all the squares, on all the corners, so much so that Ambassador Dodd is at one point in his diary moved to say, "You would almost believe the Nazis believed in Jesus." These glorious cafes that sat hundreds of people at a time. Martha went dancing, it seems to me almost every night, but she went dancing on the roof of the Hotel Eden, terrific place to go, at Chiro's, a very popular club, at this place called Haus Vaterland on Potsdamer Platz, five-story venue with five different sorts of restaurants / nightclubs. One of which was an American Wild West bar where you would be served your drinks by Nazis in cowboy hats. So here we have Ambassador Dodd arriving in Germany. Professor of history, he arrives expecting a certain level of rationality from Germany's leaders, from statesmen. Also, he arrives bearing something else, something very important. He arrives bearing the recollection of his own early years as a doctoral student in Germany. This was a very pleasant time for him. It was a time when a young woman placed violets on his pillow every day. But this world he encounters is unlike anything he experienced before and unlike anything he expected. Where he expected rationality, he finds only pathology. And here's his daughter, who in effect falls in love with the pathology at first. So I realize the two stories provide an ideal vehicle for traveling through that world. I wouldn't have wanted, it's sort of like the Devil in the White City, I would not have wanted to write only about the killer Holmes because I didn't want to write crime porn. And I wouldn't have wanted to write just about the World's Fair because, frankly, I'm not sure I could have hung an entire book on the building of the World's Fair, but together there was something bigger, the story of darkness and light. Same thing here, only these stories dovetail very nicely. Dodd, I wouldn't have wanted to write just about him because I wouldn't want to have written diplomatic history. Personally, I think it's the most god-awful, boring brand of history that exists. And I wouldn't want to write just about Martha, because it would be sort of like hanging a book on Paris Hilton. It's not my kind of thing. But the two together captured something really, I think much, much bigger and also rather telling. And also, I love the fact that both undergo a very satisfying real-life transformation in the course of that first year in Berlin, which is essentially when the action of the book takes place. And I realized something else, that their stories really did shed light on why it took America so long to appreciate, America and the world, really, took so long for the world to appreciate the true danger posed by Hitler. It kind of gives a sense of some of the early seeds of how appeasement ultimately happened. Now, some things that surprised me. One really startling element to me, and maybe this is not going to be startling to some of you in the audience, but one really startling element to me was the level of ambient anti-Semitism in America at this time. And not just in America, but among the highest officials of the U.S. State Department below Secretary Hull. Secretary Hull, by the way, was a very interesting character. He looked exactly like what you would imagine a Secretary of State should look like. But he had some odd quirks. His passion was croquet. his passion was croquet. And he had a speech impediment that, to many, reminded them of a cartoon character, Elmer Fudd. And so Roosevelt, you got to love Roosevelt. Roosevelt, in private, without Hull present, would mock him for his trade treaties. I think Hull would have been right at home in the age of Twitter and tweets and so forth. But here you have the State Department, and these top three guys are the guys who are instrumental in forming the policy of the State Department with regard to Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany. One of these officials routinely referred to Jews as kikes. Even Dodd had his own brand of anti-Semitism, as did Martha. One sort of astonishing moment in the book, Dodd writes a letter to the State Department, to his superiors there, complaining that he has too many Jews on the staff. There's too many Jews on the staff, and this is impairing his ability to deal with the Nazis. And he claims at that point that he is no race antagonist, as he puts it, but it hampers him in his affairs, especially that his bookkeeper is Jewish and has to deal with banks and Nazi officials and so forth. In a very strange conversation Dodd has with Hitler, Dodd actually tries to find common ground with Hitler during this conversation. And after Hitler has a brief outburst about Jews, Dodd says, well, you know, we have our own Jewish problem in America, but we have chosen to solve it in a different way. Meaning, although he doesn't say it point blank, he's talking about quotas and so forth. This does not mollify Hitler, by the way. Hitler becomes enraged again about the Jews, and this conversation is in 1934. This is long before the Holocaust. Hitler loses it completely and tells Dodd, if this keeps up, I will put an end to all of them. 1933. What also surprised me was the extent to which the U.S. government went to not criticize Hitler and his government. The reason for this is because Roosevelt's top priority was to drag America out of the Depression. He was trying to get his New Deal into play. The isolationists were just, well, they were really in almost full flare at this point, and any criticism of Germany, of Hitler, would have been seen as a needless provocation. It was so obvious what the government was not saying that there were attempts by some congressmen to pass bills in Congress to force Roosevelt to speak out, which led to a very interesting moment in one case. There was a bill passed by a gentleman from, a bill introduced by a gentleman from Maryland, a Senator Tidings. And this bill was evaluated by a somewhat lower level assistant secretary in the State Department, who wrote a very telling letter in which he said that, you know, one reason we can't allow this bill to pass is because if it passed and Roosevelt chose not to follow the law, he would be criticized. If he did speak out, he would be criticized because of the whole isolationist thing. But more to the point, it would leave America subject to criticism from Hitler about America's treatment of, and this is the part, this is the term they used at the time, about America's treatment of Negroes. It would expose the country to criticism from the Nazis about the fact that in Tiding's state of Maryland, there had been numerous lynchings. And it would expose us to America to criticism of the fact that anti-Semitism was running rampant at the time in our own country. So that kind of gives a sense of some of why the U.S. was reluctant at that point. I was also struck by how new everything was then. You know, all the things we today know as stereotypical emblems of the Nazi era were unfamiliar back then. The goose step, which Dodd found ridiculous the first time he saw it. He couldn't believe it. It was ridiculous. The swastika. It wasn't even called the swastika in the U.S. Embassy at this point. It was called the broken cross, which was the literal translation of the German term. The Hitler salute. Now, the Hitler salute remains such a powerful artifact that when I recently did a talk in Chicago, and my 21-year-old daughter, who goes to the University of Chicago, was in the audience, and I asked her afterwards, I said, so what did you like? What didn't you like? And she said she liked it all, but there was one moment that gave her pause. And that was when, during that particular talk, I had actually done the Hitler salute, the handout thing like that. And she said it just briefly jarred her. It's still such a powerful thing. We know it to be such a powerful thing. At the time, it was still very new. So you have to sort of put yourself back in the past. Here you are. You're in this strange country where everybody is going around doing the salute thing. It's like, what the hell is up with that? And it was so novel, actually, that I'm going to read something to you. Now, I'm going to read this, even though, as some of you may know, I really hate to hear other writers read their work. I would rather have a vasectomy without anesthetic than hear another writer read his work. Having said that, I'm going to read to you. So this is about Dodd's consul general in Berlin was a very interesting character, George Messerschmitt, an American through and through, no relation to Willy Messerschmitt, the guy who built the German fighters. This is George Messerschmitt. The nice thing about Messerschmitt is that he treated Nazi Germany kind of the way an anthropologist would treat an Aboriginal tribe. That is, he wrote with detail and at length. In fact, he wrote at length about everything and was nicknamed 40-page George because of it. There's a moment where Undersecretary Phillips is reading notes in his diary, which is a wonderful document, notes in his diary that he spent the afternoon reading three of Messerschmitt's letters, and he notes in the diary, he says, you know, that would not seem to constitute an afternoon's work, and yet it did. three letters. So anyway, this passage contains some of Messerschmitt's observations about the Hitler salute. The salute, he wrote, had no modern precedent save for the more narrowly required salute of soldiers in the presence of superior officers. What made the practice unique was that everyone was expected to salute, even in the most mundane of encounters. Shopkeepers saluted customers. Children were required to salute their teachers several times a day. At the close of theatrical performances, a newly established custom demanded that audiences stand and salute as they sang first the German national anthem and second the stormtrooper anthem, the so-called horse vessel song, named for a thug killed by communists but whom Nazi propaganda subsequently transformed into a hero. The German public had so avidly embraced the salute as to make the act of incessantly saluting almost comical. Especially in the corridors of public buildings, where everyone from the lowliest messenger to the loftiest official saluted and hailed one another, turning a walk to the men's room into an exhausting affair. My hope was to capture a sense of gradual darkening. I had this vision in my mind of two innocents entering the dark forest. It's like a Grimm Brothers fairy tale. I just love that sort of creeping sense of horror. It's like horror movies that I loved as a kid. You know, things just darker and darker and darker. I talk about how Dodd saw drafts of future Nazi laws. He would get these things secretly through various connections. He would see drafts of laws that were coming down the pike, including one that shocked him. The literal translation on the document that came to him was the law for the killing of incurables. This is a draft, something that was coming down the pike. And it's interesting, the Nazis were very sensitive at this point and were not, they weren't sure yet that they should pass this law. They felt maybe they ought to wait a little longer. But anyway, this draft comes across Dodd's desk. And of course, there you have another chilling foreshadow of the Holocaust, which is not to come for quite a few years. I talk about Martha's many loves. And there were many. I talk about Martha's many loves, including her affair with a very interesting character, Rudolf Diels, the first chief of the then brand new Gestapo. Gestapo was established in April of 1933. Diels was its first boss. He was not even a member of the Nazi Party, by the way. If you tried to imagine a head of the Gestapo, and you tried to sort of picture who this might be, Diels would be the perfect man. Perfect man because he just looked villainous. The lower part of his face was badly scarred, both sides, badly scarred because of something that young men of his era did when they were students. They would engage, to prove their manhood, they would engage in bare blade dueling with actual swords. And the point was to so mark your opponent and not kill him, so mark him that a doctor present would call the duel and award the victory to whoever was least marked, which, of course, left Diels fairly heavily scarred. However, there is, and those of you who have the book, you can take a look at Diels and tell me what you think, but Diels was considered to be a very attractive man, very charismatic, sexually on the ball, so to speak. He was charming. He was, yeah, as a test, I showed a photograph of him to probably about a dozen women in Seattle, just not on the street. I mean, there's people I know. So, I showed this picture to about a dozen women in my house at different times, and the reaction was uniform. The reaction was uniform. They look at this picture, they go, "Oh, yeah, I like this guy." You know, I describe him as a damaged Ray Milland, but you know, he had a thing about him. But here's the interesting. You know, this is a very complex and nuanced time. The interesting thing is that Dodd and others in the diplomatic community thought he was one of the best guys in the regime. They could work with him. They liked him. They thought he had a lot of integrity. He's the go-to guy they went to when they wanted to get a foreign national out of prison. And incidentally, one of the prisons just established was Dachau. It was announced at a press conference, but it was not a prison for Jews in this period. It was a prison mainly for anybody, well, solely for anybody who was an opponent of the regime, which at that point meant primarily Social Democrats, a political party, and communists. So one day, a representative of the Quakers went by train to the village of Dachau and walked from there to the camp. And he was impressed with the camp. He pronounced it to be, as prisons go, a good, warm, solid place, unlike other more ad hoc prisons that had been set up. And he was going to see a politician who had been arrested. He wanted to check on him. In the course of his visit, he talks to the commandant. The commandant tells him, he asks about the camp. The commandant tells him that there are 25 Jews in the camp. And this Quaker is too savvy for that. He's too savvy. He writes in this note back to his headquarters. He says, "Yeah, but I knew the truth. There were 50 Jews in the camp." And the reason that's sort of ironic is because, you know, we know, of course, that the camp ultimately became entirely for Jews, thousands of Jews. But here it is. He's quibbling over whether it's 25 or 50. So it was entirely a different sort of story at that point. And the commandant actually tells him at this point, "You know, if it were up to me, I'd close the camps." Strange. So Diels held the job for 1 year. He was replaced by the truly bad guys, Himmler, who then brought in his protege, Reinhard Heydrich, who was evil to the core, but who was also known, by the way, to play the violin with such passion that he would weep. And he also had, and this is the part I find exceptionally chilling, he was this evil, evil character, Heydrich. He had a very high-pitched voice. It's like being tortured by Mickey Mouse or something. But, I mean, this was a horrible guy, and he had that high-pitched thing going on. Very strange. I also learned that the Gestapo in this period often summoned people for interrogation using a postcard. You would get a postcard that would say, please present yourself at Gestapo headquarters on such and such a date at such and such a time. We'd like to talk to you. Now, can you imagine coming home at the end of a long workday? You're thumbing through your mail, and here's this postcard from the Gestapo. You know, it's like, holy Jesus. You know, what do you do? What do? Do you, try to leave? No. You know, you have to go to this meeting. Now, the problem is, the reason you were being summoned to this thing, more likely than not, had to do with a false denunciation by one of your peers. People were so willing to fall into line in Germany in this period and rat out their friends, neighbors, whoever briefly crossed them. You know, if you were annoyed at somebody for not mowing his lawn, you drop a dime on him at the Gestapo. So, you know, I heard him saying bad things about Hitler, and they would investigate. You know, it didn't take much. In fact, there were so many denunciations by so many people for petty personal grievances that even Hitler complained. He said to his justice minister, he said, and I quote, "We are living at present in a sea of denunciations and human meanness." This is Adolf Hitler. Anyway, I am very happy to report that early readers are finding the book very satisfying and dark and deeply troubling, all these things that appeal to me as a writer. A friend of mine read it, and she read it before going to bed, and woke up in the middle of the night weeping from a nightmare. In this nightmare, she's being chased by Nazis, and all she had with her was her purple Nalgene water bottle. Now, my feeling is, if I can give someone nightmares, other than my wife, if I can give someone nightmares, I consider that a victory. And on that, I'll stop and take questions. Thank you. So these folks have microphones, and they're not going to hit you with them, but if you ask questions, they're going to come running to you and give you a microphone. So my feeling is that we play with them, and we coordinate you in the front first and then way at the back, and we just kind of work that whole process. Yes, sir. Wait for the mic, please.
When the professor was in Germany working on his doctoral thesis, was that before World War One or after?
Oh, well before. It was in the late 1890s. Yeah, and by the way, he was doing his studies in Germany, and he was writing his doctoral thesis. And what was his doctoral thesis on? Thomas Jefferson. Yeah, perfect place for that research, I think. This gentleman right here.
When you did your research for this book, did you have to examine any German documents and have them translated to get the Germans' view of what the Americans were like?
You know, I had German documents translated, but mainly in support of the elements of this particular narrative. To try to capture the other side of the story in any depth would have required another volume. But there is some of that, just not a lot. This is primarily an American point of view sort of a thing. The documents that were translated are really very telling. I mean, across a broad spectrum, including Rudolf Diehl's own autobiography, which was titled Lucifer at the Gates. Lucifer at the Gates. He was known in 1933-34 as Lucifer. And he didn't mind. He liked that. People called him or referred to him as Lucifer, and it sort of gave him a little, you know, frisson of something. Yes, right there.
After completing your book, did you personally, you know, there is such a thing as, at least thought to be such a thing as national characteristics.
Right.
When you finished your book, did you yourself come away with any attitudes about German national characteristics? Because some of the things you described would have been laughed at in the United States and not have gotten to first base, but then it got to home plate in Germany. Did you come away with any attitudes about that?
Well, you know, that's a territory that is so fraught with you know, if you're asking what made people fall into line so readily, you know, I think it was a combination of things. Maybe a national trait. If there's any national trait in Germany, it's a fairly profound need for order. And in fact, you can still see that today. When I went to Berlin, I was very struck by that in some very subtle ways. Let me just talk a little bit about that first. I found, for example, that if you're in Berlin, and maybe those of you who have been to Berlin have had this experience, that all you need to do is set a single toe into the crosswalk on a street, and the traffic comes to a dead stop. It's like a scene from The Happening, you know? It's just, boom, nothing. Also, I had the occasion of staying. I went to Berlin in February, which is not the best time, but it was a logistically smart thing because I wanted low airfares and cheap hotels. I got both. I got the best hotel room probably of my life at a brand new Ritz Hotel. Corner room overlooking in the distance the Tiergarten, $180. But speaking of order, they had this breakfast, this restaurant downstairs where you were served breakfast. It's a restaurant, by the way. They made a big thing out of the fact that the restaurant was transported from France. It was a real French brasserie transported from France to this hotel and recreated in the basement, in the first floor of this hotel. And of course, I'm thinking, well, when was it transported from France? Was this a recent acquisition or previous thing? But anyway, so here's this French restaurant in the first floor of the Ritz. And by the way, it serves German food. And so breakfast runs from 7 to 10, right? 10 o'clock rolls around, and the waitress in charge takes this hammer. She takes the hammer, and she walks up to this giant brass bell, and she whacks it once. Wham! And breakfast is over. Breakfast is over. So there is this sort of, I think, a kind of a national need for order, always has been, and I think one reason Hitler appealed to everybody is because there had been so little order. There had been chaos, financial and otherwise, the inflation before this period. It was just a chaos, economic and otherwise. So I think a lot of Germans saw Hitler as the way out of that mess and also a source of order and so forth. You know, but I can't. The way I write my books, I'm not jumping up and down and saying things that you need to believe. I'm just showing you things and you can draw your conclusions. This is the sort of point of view through the eyes of these, all these complicated people. This gentleman down there.
Welcome back to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
Looking at things with the 2020 hindsight that we use, you get the sense throughout most of Europe that folks are saying in 1945, 46, oh, how can this have happened? How can this have happened? Right. And a little bit here. Yeah. But to some extent, Hitler was only keeping his campaign promises, because this is 1933.
Right.
He'd already written Mein Kampf, where he said, this is what I'll do if I ever get the chance.
That's
one.
True.
And he's saying this in, you know, in the midst of a Europe where the Jews had survived pogroms for hundreds of years already in all these countries around. So the sense that folks were sort of running around with no idea of what could go on seems to be a little bit disingenuous of some of the people who were to speak up later on.
Right.
Indeed, the Americans are saying, yes, we have a Jewish problem here too, but right, we've just found nicer ways of dealing with it. What was it? The SS, the St. Louis, went from port to port to port with the damned on board, and even when it came to, you know, the Golden Door,
we refused to lift our lamp for it and said, no, back to Auschwitz, back to Dachau, back to Bergen-Belsen.
Yeah, shocking story. Yeah, so you had a question.
How was it that, you know, how did you perceive this sense
of
folks saying, oh, where did this come from? When, indeed, even the Americans who were here, they came from Europe largely, where these programs had been going on before. And if you weren't a Jew in Europe, that wasn't what brought you to America.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there's so many ways to address that. I mean, it was an incredibly complicated period. A lot of things were in flux, and there was a lot of willful ignorance, Germans and interesting scholarship has been done about the whole issue of Nazi anti-Semitism. Not scholarship by me, but the pioneer in this field, who's brilliant, is Sir Ian Kearshaw, and I steer you to his work. But one of the points that he makes about anti-Semitism in Germany is that to the average German, it was kind of an abstract thing. It's an abstract thing. And frankly, I see parallels with how we all view illegal aliens. It's kind of an abstract thing to most of us. And yeah, we've got armed posses on the Arizona border hunting these people down, and we're not doing anything about it, are we? So, you know, you had this anti-Semitic policy of the Third Reich, which was very effective for those who were adherents from the get-go to the Third Reich, members of the Nazi Party, the stormtroopers, and so forth. But the reality was there were relatively few Jews in Germany. And Kearshaw makes the point that the typical or the average, and there was no such thing as an average German, but the average German had very little contact with Jews. The few Jews that did live in Germany lived typically in the cities, and within those cities often lived in fairly tight, coherent neighborhoods. And his point is that this anti-Semitic campaign was to many an abstract thing. They didn't like it necessarily. They didn't do anything to stop it. And so that kind of, you know, when that kind of just sort of allowed things to begin to happen. So that's just one aspect. One of the things that I'm finding kind of intriguing, and I didn't really count on this, but I'm glad. It sort of adds an element of narrative tension. I'm glad as a writer. These people are telling me, you know, like, I read this thing, and I kept asking, why isn't anybody doing anything to stop these people? Why is no one stopping these people? And that's a valid question. Why was no one stopping these people? George Messersmith, in a September or was it June, in a 1933 document, actually raises the idea that one solution would be preemptive war. 1933. And yet, we all think, yeah, go for it. But nothing would have been less possible in 1933 than to have Roosevelt say, we're sending troops to Germany to clear out these scum. He couldn't have done it. He simply could not have done it given the domestic, political, and economic situation. But anyway, it's a very complicated, nuanced time. It's fascinating to me. I mean, there's so much that I did not know about this period. So let's see. Somebody over here, this person. Wait.
I need a mic. Was there a pivotal event that changed Mary's mind about how she felt about the Nazis, or was it a gradual awakening?
Martha.
Yeah.
Was there a pivotal event that changed Martha's mind? For Martha, for Dodd, there was a pivotal event that really shook him, and that was it for him, caused utter disillusionment. I don't necessarily want to say what that is because it's the climax of the book. For Martha, it was a gradual accretion of things, episodes, things that she encounters, things that she tried to talk away, and then something else would happen. And then in the end, she, of course, comes around as well and in large part is shoved over the edge by this climactic event. What she does with that transformation is a fascinating element of the story. And some of a certain generation in this room probably even recall the amount of press it got at that time. Another question. Let's see. Another from this side? No? How about this person in the front row? Right here.
I really enjoyed this talk.
She says she really enjoyed this talk.
I did. I worked with students on a Holocaust contest, and one of the things I was asking them to do.
I don't even want to know what a Holocaust contest is.
Well, it was an art contest addressing the Holocaust and
right.
various themes about the Holocaust.
Right.
But yeah, maybe that wasn't said as well as it could have been said. But Hitler didn't kill 6 million people. Hitler, they didn't kill 6 million people. They had lots of volunteers. So my question to my students often was, what is it, or my question to myself was, what is it about people? And with all your research, have you come to any kind of conclusions about why we as a race, the human race, are so willing to go along, get along?
Yeah, you know, again, I do have to emphasize, this is not a book about the Holocaust. This is sort of, if anything, it's a book about the seeds of all that was to come. So I have to truly say I didn't get too much into that territory other than sort of by just reading widely and promiscuously and otherwise about all things involving this era. I think that remains a mystery for people, you know, how... You know, there's that famous book, and controversial in Germany, Hitler's Willing Executioners. There's a great sense of denial, but I think scholarship has now more than confirmed that that's the way it was. That people, the only part of my book that really supports that, and again, this is the seeds, this is the first chill wind of the Holocaust that supports that in my book, is the fact that people were falling over themselves to get what was referred to as coordinated. There was a plan, there was this program by the government, which I hadn't known anything about before this. It's a chilling thing called the coordination. It reminded me of you know, that movie, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You know, people reported, as this coordination program got underway, people reported that they would leave their village to go maybe traveling in Switzerland or skiing for a couple of weeks, and they'd come back, and in that short time, everything had changed. How neighbors reacted to them, how they reacted to neighbors, even how people cut their hair and how they looked, it just changed because they were term arose called self-coordination. They were so interested in going along that they would coordinate themselves. This was self-coordination. They would fall into line even when nobody was asking them to. And that offers kind of a window, I think, on what was eventually to come. So, yeah. Two more questions. Well, let's see now. This guy right here.
You've portrayed Holmes. You've portrayed Goebbels. Holmes is much further removed. Goebbels seems to be a more immediate figure. Did it give you some stress, some problem in avoiding the 2020 hindsight in your portrayal of some of these real bad guys?
That's a good question. Did everybody hear that question, or should I repeat it? He's asking about, given... Correct me if I'm wrong. Given the fact that I do have 20/20 hindsight, was it difficult to portray these guys in the past? Or what stress did that apply? And, you know, of course, I did know about these characters. But my goal was, again, to adhere as strictly as possible to a particular point of view, POV, as they call it, and all that went with it. For example, those of you who read the book will note that I never refer to World War I because there had not yet been a World War II. It was the Great War, it was the past war, it was the previous war. So I really struggled at all turns to eliminate any reference, even in terms of words that may not have existed at the time, anything that would take you out of that point of view. So it was difficult, but on the other hand, it was not as difficult as maybe one might think, because if you simply go with what you've got and try to put yourself in that position. For example, talk about meaty figures, Goering. Meaty because he weighed about 350 pounds. He was gigantic. He was also interestingly considered to be one of the better men of the Third Reich by foreigners. Sigrid Schultz, the correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, said that at least with Goering you could be in the same room with him. You know, he had good table manners. Nobody else did. You know, it's that kind of thing. But with Goering, you know, it was really simply a matter of, you know, we all know what he eventually did with the bombing of Britain and so forth. But I found it actually relatively easy to talk about him in his role at the time, simply dealing with him as he was, without trying to bring anything else into it. It's when you start get up on a soapbox and start spouting that you run into trouble with point of view. For example, you know, I was able to talk about, well, one of my favorite moments in the book is when there is a concert at the Italian embassy, and all these ornate, delicate little gilt chairs were set out throughout the room. You can picture this, right? And Martha Dodd is seated, her mother is seated in one row, and Goering, resplendent in one of his many uniforms, he liked to design new uniforms at will, and this was his white, glorious uniform. Goering sat in the chair right in front of Martha's mother. And Martha's mother describes his heart-shaped rump spilling over the chair and how she spent the entire concert terrified that the chair was going to break and he was going to come plummeting into her lap, you know. So there's an image of the time, but I don't get up and say, this is the guy who later bombed Berlin, bombed London, you know. What it takes is finishing the book and then going through it and saying, okay, is this a departure from point of view? Is this a departure from point of view? And then just getting it out of there. So one more, I think. We're allowed one more, right? Didn't somebody way back? Yes, way back there. Faster. Way in the back. I have daughters. So I can do this. Yes.
So I know you've spoken a lot about the research you've done for these books, but I was sort of curious about the creative process that goes along with sort of creating a narrative out of the historical details, and if you feel intimidated at all starting out trying to sort of create the unknowable details of daily life and that would go into the dramatic scenes that you end up painting.
And your question is?
How you go about doing that, or how you, if you feel intimidated about sort of going about, because obviously you can't know.
Well, you know, it's always intimidating, but the beauty of detail, you know, if you go the distance, if you immerse yourself as deeply as you possibly can, and you find the kind of things that you need to find, the beauty of detail is that it doesn't take a lot of detail. It takes that one detail that really lights a fire in the imagination. So really your quest is, I mean, yes, you can string a lot of details together, but you're looking for those wonderful telling things. Otherwise, what you've got is like University of Nebraska history or regimental history of the Civil War. You know, what you wanted, but detail is very, very powerful. What you use and how sparingly you use it is so powerful, because what happens is the reader is the one who brings the connective tissue to the narrative. The reader connects the dots. For example, I've often had people come up to me and say, well, you must have made up this scene because it's got dialogue. Well, there's no made-up dialogue in this book, in any book that I've written. Anything between quotes is from a historical document of some kind. It's the reader who reads this stuff and says, oh, that's dialogue. You made that up. And then jumps on the website and screams at you a few times and you hit trash, and it's over. anyway, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.